Back in March of 2013, on my very first day of work as a multimedia producer at the Ed School, I went to cover a conference for Pathways to Prosperity, a project that started as a report and has grown into a network that is working to re-envision how our education systems partner with employers to prepare students for career success. Recently, more than 5 years after I made that first video, I got to sit down with Bob Schwartz and Nancy Hoffman, who are the co-founders of Pathways to Prosperity, as well as HGSC faculty members and co-authors of a new book, Learning for Careers. I want to jump right into the part of our conversation where Nancy is sharing some of the things they've learned over the years. I'm your guest host, Iman Rastegari, and this is the Harvard EdCast.
There were some things we discovered in the work that we hadn't really anticipated. And one of them, I mean, we knew that work-based learning was important for exploring your interests and so forth, but we really hadn't thought, as we have now for the last 4 or 5 years, about how little schools teach about the role of work in human lives and how much time adults spend at work. So a nice statistic, you will spend about 90,000 hours in your lifetime at work. So more than watching TV, more than sleeping, more than a lot of other activities. And most students, unless they have parents who take them to their workplaces or take them to see friends who are scientists or train conductors or whatever, don't really learn much about work. And then they go to college. If they go to a four-year college, they may never visit a career center till it's time to graduate. They may have vague ideas, but they don't really have much thinking about it. So the work-based learning experience is important, not just so you can explore, but so you can understand what work is, learn how to work. And increasingly, we're talking about the development of social capital in work sites, because if you look at the data, you will see that for low-income students, the message is get a college degree, it'll all be fine. But it won't be fine, because you need to have a network, you need to know who to ask, you need to know how to behave, you need to know a whole bunch of mainstream skills that many kids don't have access to. So we also see that in workplaces, very naturally, really useful relationships form with adults that can be very helpful to young people. So that's two pieces there. If you go to in New York City, there are a few, there are 16 early college high schools now from our first cohort. Some of those have very strong career pathways. I just did a blog about one called Energy Tech, which is partnered with Con Edison and National Grid. Their employees are in and out of the school. The school has very close working relationship and can visit and provide internships. Students are graduating with substantial college credit. So that's what we're really trying to do, is to break down the school walls a bit, get students started on post-secondary, which means if you're a low-income first-generation student, the best way to know you can do college work is to do it. And if you graduate from high school, on average, our early college students get about a year of college credit that's transferable. Then the likelihood is that you will go on. And what we see from the long-term work with early college and the cohorts we followed is the average is about a year. About a third or more students are getting a full associate's degrees while in high school, some transferring to as juniors to a university, others going into the labor market. And we see much higher rates of retention and completion than you would expect for the demographic.
I would just underscore one point here, and that is, if you think about one of the manifestations of the huge inequality, whether you want to call it the wealth gap, the income gap in the country, is that if you're raised in a middle-class household, you're raised to believe you have a right to a job, and a right to a job that is, that is a satisfying job. And if you're poor and raised in a household, and obviously a right to some kind of college education, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're raised in a low-income household, you may not be raised with either of those assumptions. And so a big chunk of this work for us is really getting young people started on post-secondary while they're in high school and getting them some kind of significant internship or other extended work-based learning experience while we've still got them, you know, in high school. And I'm working closely with New York City, and there we're trying to put a stake in the ground around those two ideas. Whether you can do it in a city of the size and scale of New York is a challenge, but we're trying to push this idea that, you know, every kid ought to have a right to both things before leaving. And the other point about that, of course, is that the message is it's no longer a question of college or career. It's got to be both, and those two have to be really connected to one another. That's the next kind of bridge that we've got to try to cross here.
So you mentioned, you referred to this as an issue, right? The school-to-work issue. And it sounds like there have been a lot of challenges along the way, in particular with resistance to this idea of career-focused education. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about those challenges and how you overcame them so that other people who want to do this work or who are interested in this can maybe, what are some lessons that they can pull from that?
So overcoming, I would say, not overcame.
Yes.
That's the big challenge. So I would say in the 7 years now since the report, the public conversation has changed. In fact, it's changed so much that I have my fears about the future of the liberal arts, which is a whole other piece of this problem, because community colleges, governors, legislatures, business leaders are getting so instrumental now about the purposes of higher education that you begin to worry, are students going to still get the thing that's of such high value in the U.S. higher ed system, which is a broad liberal education? That aside, that's a new problem. The biggest challenge, I think, is the employer getting employers to open their doors to teenagers. This is just not in the culture here. Employers have a rather short-term view of the world. If it takes you 3 years, starting with a 16-year-old in Switzerland, to get them ready to do a full-time job, that's just something that we don't think about. Even in Switzerland, the 4-year apprenticeship costs about $120,000 a year, but you end up in the end with a productive person. Actually, the apprentices start doing productive work early, I mean, almost immediately. So you gain back a small amount of money, and you have someone that you know very well, and whom you've trained, and who is loyal. That's not the culture here. So there's a lot of churn.
The other thing I'd say about that, by the way, I mean, one of the fears that we still run into here is early tracking. Mm-hmm. Are you asking kids at the age 16, you know, to make this, pick a career? Are they going to be slotted there forever? Can they move? And people still have that stereotype about the European systems. The thing about the Swiss system in particular is that kids come out of their apprenticeship, you know, just with a whole set of skills that enable them to then take more control, have more agency over their lives. We've done three tours with, you know, bringing Americans to see that system, and we have a wonderful friend there who ran the federal office for a dozen years, and she always puts together one evening, just from her own friends and relations, a panel of 25-year-olds. And it turns out half of them typically are not working in the field that they did their apprenticeship in, you know, but they have the sense that I now have a solid set of underpinning skills so I can really move and navigate. And the Swiss have created a very permeable system with a whole set of universities of applied sciences that really exist, you know, to enable people to go all the way through to an MBA if they choose on that side, without ever setting foot in the traditional universities, which are much narrower in their scope. The other big culture issue continues to be, obviously, the perception among particularly middle class and professional parents that the only acceptable outcome of high school is a 4-year college degree. I think our report, not alone by itself, but because it came from Harvard, frankly, and because it was written by a journalist, I think we began to at least put on the table some reasons to enable people to start to think differently. And I think the continuing data around the high dropout rates, the high debt rates, and the fact that we now have data, suggesting that people with two-year technical degrees, depending on the region that they're in, are out-earning four-year degree holders on average, even 10 years, you know, post-graduation. So, you know, but still, at the end of the day, you know, parents, you know, and particularly, by the way, I think this is a particular problem with African-American parents, and understandably, given the legacy of vocational programs being dead-end, dumping-ground programs, you know, for kids that were kind of shut it off to, you know, people didn't think they could do academic work, et cetera, et cetera. Two of our strategies to address that particular concern, I mean, one has been that, you know, even though you can make a damn good living as a plumber, a carpenter, or electrician, those are not the fields that we focus on. We tend to focus on the newer emerging, you know, IT technician level jobs in the healthcare sector, advanced manufacturing, which are not the, you know, don't fit the stereotype of the traditional trades and crafts. And the second thing, obviously really important, is this is not an alternative to college. It's, this is, you know, another path to a post-secondary credential. And I think those two things have been really important as part of the messaging. But Nancy's right. It's not as if we've won any battles there. This is a continuing, you know, marketing communications challenge. And as we start to get more evidence, and again, remember, we're really only, you know, five or, this is year six, really. Mm-hmm. We're, you know, only in a few places do we have people who are yet in post-secondary education, you know what I mean? So it'll be a while before.
The other thing is, as we've moved along, it's not so much that there are lessons we learned, it's gaps we identified.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some of it, you know, you can say all the nice big things, but ultimately they're details that have to be worked out. So we've developed expertise in a whole variety of areas that you wouldn't have anticipated. We are doing a lot of pathways mapping, for example, working with employers and community college faculty to try and better align employer needs and curriculum. And if you're in a university, that is not, you know what faculty are like. They do it the way they do it, and they need to change, and that's hard. So that's slow work. We're also back mapping those pathways all the way through to high school, I mean, community college, high school by high school, because what we discovered was when students, it was nice. You could say, oh, these students took, you know, 100 students took 200 college courses while they were in high school. But if you look to see what those courses were, many of them were too specific to really be helpful as you chose a pathway. So we are carefully looking at what's a foundation of healthcare course? How does it tell people about the various pathways? Which courses actually leave open the opportunity to do five different pathways in healthcare, not just one? Those kinds of things are what makes an initiative high quality. So that's one example. We're actually building on the work of the Boston Private Industry Council, we've developed a way of helping communities do a job shadow. Well, a job shadow, you know, it can be, oh, just go follow these nice multimedia producer guy around for the day, and you can see him, you know, writing things on a pad and adjusting a microphone. That doesn't really do the trick. There has to be reflection and study before. There has to be training for the nice multimedia guy so he knows what to do. You as a student need to know what to wear and what to say, and you need to be able to evaluate the experience afterwards. So one of the interesting, most interesting places we're working right now is Lawrence High School, and anyone who's in Massachusetts and follows education will know that's a big turnaround story, probably one of the most successful in the country. So the high school has 3,200 kids, and it's a going high school, and it doesn't have a person to do a lot of planning. The principal, who's terrific, is leading the planning, and we're working with them. So it's sort of piece by piece, but we just, so in this, and it's got foundation funding now as well as extra state funding. We're in this, really the first implementation year of early college, so there are 160 students already taking courses at Northern Essex and Merrimack Colleges. We just had a first job shadow day where 63 kids went to 23 employers. There was a big celebration afterwards and a press conference, and Comcast was there. I mean, these are all the kinds of things that on the ground actually begin to make a difference. The employers get good vibes from it. The kids get good vibes from it. The school, in a non-authoritarian way, begins to think about where are these young people headed and what can our community do to support them. So that's sort of what it looks like. And I think it's really important to see that the idea is great, policy is great, but it's the care and implementation that really is what takes a long time and a process of discovery.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm wondering, before we close, if you wanted to share a little bit about what the process of writing this book together was like. You two have known each other for a long time. You've been working on this for a long time, but what was that process like?
So we've known each other for 53 years?
Something like that, yeah.
We met when I was a college freshman, and he was a graduate student, but we didn't get married for a while after.
It's interesting. I mean, we started, first thing we did was we started teaching together here a few years ago, and we survived that. The students got used to the fact that we would interrupt one another. One of the most touching things that happened at the end of one class, when we went around to do this exercise that my colleague Richard Elmore always, taught me about, I used to think, but now I think. And one kid in the back row, made a really nice comment about, what he really...
A young man.
Yeah, a young man. About observing our marriage. This was the thing that he took from the course. And that was possible to actually have
a respectful marriage.
What looked like a respectful marriage. And we used to joke and say, this is, you're going to learn the following kinds of things in the course, and you're going to have a chance to see the inside dynamics of a marriage.
We have different ways of writing.
Yeah, but that's...
Bob writes very carefully, and then it's all written. I write tons, and then it's agonizing editing. But I get lots of words and lots of paper. He's very good at organizing. I'm good at filling up pages. So that works pretty well.
So, and the chapters kind of sorted themselves out relatively easily in terms of which play to our respective...
We had one big fight. Just one. When I went off to give a talk somewhere and he edited something I'd written.
I thought I would helpfully edit something.
Yes, but he didn't do it in track changes, and I couldn't figure out what he'd done. Luckily, my son and his wife, who were visiting and who were both professors, took my side and said that was a really evil thing to do.
A terrible breach of writing etiquette.
But we survived. We wrote it pretty fast. That was the other part of it.
We did in two concentrated chunks, one in the summer and then a few months later over a Christmas. We spent our Christmas break, frantically doing this. It's funny. I mean, the impulse to do it, part I have to say that Doug Clayton, the publisher of the Harvard Ed Press, had a strong interest in our work. He published an earlier book of Nancy's called Schooling in the Workplace.
Two books.
Right, yeah. but in this particular field, he was really interested, and he's the one who kind of pushed us to do it. And when we first talked about it, each of us had written, we had so many, we had a half a dozen pieces. We thought, this will be easy. We'll just put together our articles and write a little connective tissue. And once we actually looked at it, we said, no, this is going to require us to have to.
That was also boring to rehash the stuff we'd done already.
But it was, part of the impulse was, 5 years in, we were really clear that this was, stage one of what has to be a long, this system change work does not happen in 5 years. Maybe in 10 you can begin to see, some change. But sort of putting this down as a kind of marker, and here's where we are now, we thought it would be helpful to us, really, for as much as for our own sake, to kind of reflect on where we were.
We also have a different attitude toward the book now. Bob's the marketing director. Yes. For me, once it was done, it was done. And if anyone read it, good for them, but I'm not doing anything more.
And my point was, we wrote the damn thing. Now I want people to read it, So I've been the marketing director. Shamelessly. She hides under the desk sometimes.
With a colleague teaching a course at HGSC called New College and Career Pathways. And we did use the book.
Well, that's great. I'm wondering, if people want to learn more about your work outside of the book, where can they go?
They can Google Pathways to Prosperity, Jobs for the Future. There's plenty of material on the JFF website. Just so that you know, we are 150 people working across the country on workforce development and education. Most of us are in Boston. We have remote staff, and we have an Oakland and a Washington office. You can always stop by and visit.
And what is that website?
www.jff.org.
Yeah, and on that site, there's a whole separate, if you Pathways to Prosperity Network
It's a password protected site.
But well, we have a separate pathways protected site, but the public site you get to through JFF. This is a very equal partnership. It's a 150-person organization with a 15-person team and me representing Harvard Graduate School of Education. We bill it as a collaborative, but it's effectively really runs out of JFF. And although I should say, at least half the people on our team
went to
with Amy Loy, who's now the real leader of the network, who was in the first cohort of the EDLD program, the Leadership Development Program at the Ed School. The number two person in the network is a relatively recent graduate of the EDD program, which is the more research-oriented program. And several of the other people on the team have master's degrees from the school. So there really is more of a HGSE presence there than just you know with me.
Well, for our listeners, the book is Learning for Careers, The Pathways to Prosperity Network. Bob Schwartz, Nancy Hoffman, thank you so much for joining me on the Harvard EdCast.
Our pleasure.
You are very good to have listened.
This is the Harvard EdCast, a production of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. This is Iman Rastegari. Thanks so much for listening.